We come this morning then, if we can, to the final words of the Apostle Paul. A couple of weeks ago, we began looking at chapter 4 of 2 Timothy. You remember I said chapter 4 really begins in verse 6. And we started by looking at the first bit of that passage in which Paul gives a review of his life, if you will. He addresses, or I should say, he announces his departure. He says, I have been poured out like a drink offering. The time of my departure is near. And we talked about the fact that Paul is announcing the fact that he believes that he is about to face the end of his life. He's about to face execution. And then he analyzes his faithfulness. He calls his departure an analysis. And so he does a bit of analysis for himself. He looks at himself and says that he finds himself to have run the race. He has fought the fight. He has kept the faith. And so he believes that he stands now in a place where he can anticipate his reward. The crown of righteousness is waiting for him. And that crown is not some gold-plated thing that they'll put on his head, but rather the very presence of Christ himself. The very goal of all of the Christian faith is to pursue this Christ to the point where we see him face to face. He sees us face to face, puts his arm around us and says, well done, good and faithful servant. And so Paul begins this final passage in this letter by doing a bit of review of his own life. But when we get to verse 9, Paul turns back to doing what he does typically at the end of his letters, which is to make some personal comments. Now, it's not as though those three verses weren't personal. They were very personal. They were extraordinarily personal. But in this case, he makes some more personal comments about this. He closes the letter by making some references, as we'll see here, to some common acquaintances that Timothy had with himself. And he will bring those names up. So what we have in these last verses, starting in verse 9, is very similar to what we see in many of other Paul's letters. Let's look at Romans 16. For example, and you see a very similar kind of thing where Paul will make some connection between his audience and himself by virtue of some common acquaintances. In verses 9 to 22, though, what Paul's really going to do here, in the midst of these very personal comments, is he's going to address his current situation. Now, let me ask you a question. We spent a Sunday talking about Paul making an announcement of his departure, right, and then doing a bit of analysis about his own life and his faithfulness and so forth, and then talking about the fact that he's waiting for this crown of righteousness. Here's my question. How would Timothy have taken those words? How would the audience, Timothy, have received that announcement? What would have been his first reaction to Paul writing, I am being poured out like a drink offering, the time of my departure is near? I think sometimes we have a tendency to sterilize these books because we're 2,000 years removed from them. And we forget that there's humans behind these books. Timothy was a flesh and blood man living in a place in a particular time. And he receives this piece of papyrus from Tychicus, probably, and he reads these words. How would he have responded to this? My guess, and I think this is a pretty good guess, that Timothy would have been shocked and grieved and deeply saddened by what he read. Deeply saddened by this. Remember, Timothy isn't just some guy living in Ephesus that Paul happens to know. No. Timothy is a close, personal friend of this Paul. They are co-laborers, yes. Okay, I get it. They worked together in advancing the cause of Christ in Asia Minor for a very long period of time. And Paul certainly was Timothy's mentor, and Timothy spent a great deal of time learning. But Paul speaks of Timothy in language such as, you are my child in the faith. And they've spent massive amounts of time together, journeying together and preaching and teaching together and learning together and struggling through various oppositions along the way. As Paul is being stoned in Lystra, for example, is Timothy just standing by and going, too bad for him. No, there's a deep sense of connection between these two individuals. They have suffered together. They have striven together. They have a vision that's similar to one another. For Timothy to read these words are words that would be crushing to him. My friend is about to die. And by the way, just one other thought. This letter is not an email. Okay? This is not an email. I don't know how long it would have taken for this letter to get from Rome to Ephesus, but it would have taken potentially months to get there. One of the first thoughts that could come to Timothy's mind when reading verses 6 to 8 is my friend already dead? Maybe he's already gone. So these are words that when Paul writes them, when I'm referring to 6 to 8, when Paul writes 6 to 8, he knows that those words are going to be shocking for his friend to receive. So verses 9 to 22 are designed, I think, by Paul to comfort his friend, to bring some comfort to this Timothy. Yes, I'm about to depart. Yes, I'm about to go away. I'm about to go into the presence of God. I'm about to leave this world. You will never see me again. You may never see me again. But I want you to have some comfort in the midst of it. So some of what you see filtering in 9 to 22 is Paul attempting to comfort his friend. But there's something else. And I must confess that I really wrestled with this over the course of the week. Because what I'm about to say is a bit controversial. And it's this. It also appears, however, that Paul is also and primarily reaching out to Timothy for comfort himself. Now, why is that controversial? Well, because many of us have this view of Paul, I must confess at times that I do, that Paul is this stalwart, stoic fellow that nothing ever gets him down and he faces every situation with profound faith in this Christ and he's never taken off guard and he's ready for everything. And even when he writes in verses 6 to 8, he writes stoically, I'm departing, I'm going to the presence of Christ, my crown of righteousness is waiting for me. And we think, this guy has got it all together. When they chop off his head, he'll be just fine. But he's human, too. Deeply human, as we are. So I am suggesting that not only is Timothy mourning here, but so is Paul. That Paul is also mourning here. And these are very personal comments that reflect that emotion in him. In verse 9, Paul says, do your best to come to me soon. And then down in verse 21, he says, do your best to come before winter. And you will notice those bookend each other, which I'll have you hold as a thought. When Deb and I were in Birmingham, we attended Chase Mountain Baptist Church there under the leadership of Dr. Charles Carter for most of those years. Dr. Danny Wood took over for him about three quarters of the way through our time there. But every year in October, Dr. Carter would preach a sermon that he entitled Come Before Winter. Every year, it was exactly the same message. You could almost take out your notes from the previous year and just follow along. It was just one of the things that he did. It was, if I might summarize it rather simplistically, it was basically what I would call an annual evangelistic appeal. An annual evangelistic appeal. It was a call for people to do what they are called to do before it's too late. The fundamental message was, winter is coming. You need to do now what you need to do before winter gets here. Okay? And the basic premise is based on these two verses that I just read to you a moment ago. Now, it was a well-meaning sermon. I mean, the intention was good. But the problem was is that it was a typical example of preaching designed to encourage specific behavior, but with little doctrinal foundation to support that behavior over the long term. The fundamental question was always, why should I come before winter? Okay, why should I do what I'm supposed to do before it's quote unquote, too late. As though rote behavior is what it is that Christ expects from us. Just do what you're supposed to do whenever you're supposed to do it. The fact of the matter is, and I bring up that example because that's not where Paul is going to go. Paul isn't interested in Timothy just doing what he's supposed to do. There's something deeper here involved in this situation. Now, Paul does encourage his young apprentice to come to Rome soon. He uses that word soon, which he defines in verse 21 as before winter. Now, we can therefore guess that this letter was probably written during the summer months, potentially even in the spring, Paul anticipating the fact that eventually winter was going to come. In other words, it's come to me before the travel channels on the Mediterranean close. The journey from Ephesus to Rome would be much easier and quicker by sea. But once the sea lanes close in, say, early October, it would be virtually impossible to get to Rome. If you've done any work with a map, you know that to get from Ephesus to Rome via land means that you literally have to go north and east from Ephesus, back up to where modern Istanbul is today, cross over under the Black Sea into the various Serbian nations, Croatia, etc., cross all the way through that territory to the north of Italy, and then come south through the mountainous territory in the north of Italy down to Rome itself. A journey of at least 800 miles. And it wouldn't be done by airplane, and it wouldn't be done by automobile. And so it would be a very difficult journey. So Paul says, go to Troas, get on a boat, and get over here now, because all you would have had to do is simply travel across the Aegean, below Greece, Cyprus, and or Crete, and Sicily, and around to Rome. No problem. Would have been a lot simpler. So Paul says, come. Come soon. Come before winter. But that word soon has another connotation to it, and the other connotation is, come before I'm gone. Right? Come before I'm no longer here. That would be the obvious implication. Before the executioner comes, as Paul anticipates. Now, I'd have you know, Paul must believe that he has some time left. Okay? Because otherwise, why would he say, come soon? Obviously, he believes that there's enough time for Timothy to make such a journey over to him. Otherwise, he wouldn't have made such an invitation. He would have simply said, I'm going to be gone by the time you get this letter. So Paul must believe that he has time. By the way, just in case you haven't figured it out, the first arrest of Paul that we have at the end of the book of Acts, which starts in Acts 22 and runs through the end of the book and is intimated elsewhere, takes more than 4 years to be resolved. 5 years, give or take, before it's finally resolved and Paul is released. And so Paul may simply say, look, this is going to take a while, just like it did the last time, and so you've got time to come. He also, by the way, notes in here, bring some things with you because I still have some time. Down in verse 13. Bring the cloak that I left with Carpus at Troas and the books and the parchments. I need those things. While I'm languishing here, I need my books, I need my notes, I need my cloak, because it's cold here and it's probably going to get cold when winter comes. So I need these things because I still have time. So go up there and get these things and bring them to me. But the word soon clearly means come before I'm gone. Okay? So, Paul extends an invitation to his friend to come and visit him in Rome. Now, the question is why? The real question always should be why. And that word for at the beginning of verse 10 is the clue that this is what Paul is doing here. Do your best to come to me soon. For. Okay, that word for means here's my explanation as to why. Here's why. Paul feels deserted and alone. Paul feels deserted and alone. Now, I want you to notice something here. Verses 10 through 21 are ad hoc. I'm convinced they're ad hoc, meaning they weren't thought out very well. They're not polished. They're more off the cuff. as would be typical of making personal comments. I mean, when you're writing a theological diatribe, you're thinking through logically of what you're going to say, when you're going to say it. But when you get to a place where you start making personal comments, it becomes much more difficult. You will notice how much more polished my sermons are than my ad hoc comments at the beginning. Because when you start making personal comments, you kind of wander around and you say stupid things. Which I did again this morning. I mean, you do say dumb things. And so, so Paul is writing sort of I'm not suggesting anything here is dumb, but Paul makes ad hoc comments, and so it's not quite as organized. So if you walk out of here this morning feeling like this sermon is not very organized, you'll know why. It's his fault. I think that this is Paul's attempt to communicate his feelings of loneliness and despair in the face of death. In some ways, and this is not a comparison by any stretch of the imagination, but in some ways it's sort of like Jesus in the garden addressing the reality of his own death. Now, again, Paul is nowhere here going to suggest that his agony is anything like what Jesus experienced in the garden. But it's a similar idea. The idea meaning as one approaches that mortality, one begins to have certain feelings that come. Loss, grief, failure, etc. And so I think this is Paul's way of attempting to communicate his feelings of loneliness and despair in the face of what he knows is coming. Even this great man of the faith, even this tremendous apostle, struggles with these things. His humanness really appears here. In verses 10 to 14 then, Paul, and verse 20, Paul mentions 10 different people related to this sense of loneliness. Okay? Notice how this works. As Paul is thinking about the fact that he is going to die, he's thinking about Timothy being left alone in Ephesus. He knows his friend is going to grieve. He himself is feeling a sense of sadness that, you know, death is coming. He's not afraid of death. He's probably more afraid of dying. And so he's dealing with these natural feelings that would come up. It is 10 different people that have been a part of his life which demonstrate or exacerbate this sense of loneliness. Okay? 10 different folks. Demas. Demas is the co-worker that has deserted him to go back to Thessalonica. He's not here anymore. He's gone back to one of the places where Paul had been in the previous journey. We'll come back to him in a minute. Crescens. Crescens is an unknown co-worker of Paul that has gone to Galatia. Galatia is Central Asia Minor. So he's gone back to Galatia for whatever reason. Probably for good reason, though. Okay, I am not reading this text in this way. That Demas deserted me, so did Crescens, and so did Titus. I'm not reading it that way. I'm reading it as Demas deserted me, but Crescens and Titus have left for good reason. But they're not here. Titus, next. Probably, I'm convinced, it's the same Titus as the next letter in your Bible. I think this is the same man, a close friend and co-laborer that has gone to Dalmatia, modern Croatia, on the north shore of the Adriatic. Again, for good reason. You remember Paul had sent Titus to Crete in the first place. We see that in the next letter in order to establish elders in the various churches there. And so this was a man that Paul felt at liberty to send other places to do things. And so probably, again, I'm just speculating, but probably Paul has at some point sent Titus off. I want you to go to Dalmatia, to this place, and I want you to do work there just like you did in Crete. So Crescens and Titus have gone away. So these three men, Demas, Crescens, and Titus, have left me. They're not with me anymore. Now, two for good reason. And I'm feeling quite alone. He brings those three names up, I think, very quickly in order to say, listen, three people who I counted on, three people who were important to me, who were a part of my life, are not with me now. Which leads to Luke. Verse 11, Luke alone is with me. Now we know, of course, I'm convinced that this is the beloved physician and author that joined Paul on his second missionary journey in Acts 16. I'm pretty sure this is the author of the third gospel and the author of the book of Acts. I'm quite confident in that. Now, Luke being with Paul is a good thing, right? I mean, Luke alone is with me. So, why would Paul still feel a sense of loneliness if his friend is here? I think the reason, based on what he says in verses 16 and following, that the general sense he now feels is one of desertion by many. Yes, there are still people with him. Down in verse 16, there's going to be a few other people that he will mention. Eubulus and Pudens. They're still here. But what Paul is feeling is this general sense of desertion, as though so many have abandoned him. Luke is with him, and that's a good thing. But even so, even in the midst of having this personal friend with him, he still has this strong sense of loneliness, as though so many are not with him. Which then he instructs Timothy in the middle part of verse 11, get Mark, John Mark, and bring him with you, for he's very useful to me. Now, again, I'm convinced that this is the Mark who wrote the second gospel, the John Mark who went with Paul and Barnabas on the first missionary journey and then turned around and abandoned him in Acts 13. Shortly into the trip, they're not very far along, they run into some persecution. John Mark splits and goes away. And you remember that Paul had refused to bring him along on the second missionary journey, which caused a rift between him and Barnabas. And so Barnabas took John Mark and went in one direction, and Paul took Silas and went in another direction, which we would argue is actually the will of God to separate the two men and send them on two different directions rather than one. Whatever. But now, Paul sees him as useful to me. And I want you to notice something here. John Mark abandoned the mission, didn't he? He walked away from what it was that Paul and Barnabas were doing on that first journey. He abandoned the mission, but he did not abandon the faith. He did not abandon the Christian faith. He was restored. And he became an effective gospel worker. He became someone who caught up with Peter, and many would say, I think Brian has said this to me, that Mark basically just took Peter's rendition of the work of Christ and wrote it down. Which makes perfect sense. So he's a man who is not an apostate. Okay? He's not an apostate. Yes, he abandoned a work. He abandoned some particular mission. But he didn't abandon the faith. And we need to be very careful to distinguish between true apostasy and simple failure. It's possible to fail a mission work or to walk away from a work without abandoning the faith. I remember when I resigned from Hebron back in 2003, I was not walking away from the ministry. Some asked me that. Oh, are you done with the ministry now? Are you going to quit preaching now? No. I'm abandoning this work because it is over and there's nothing more I can do here. But the fact is, I'm not abandoning the ministry. I'm going to go get educated. I'm going to go do it again. So apostasy is not defined as simply walking away from a work. Apostasy is walking away from the faith. And there's a very real difference, and we will look at a particular character or two in a minute who are examples of that. Now, notice what Paul does here. He invites John Mark to come as well. See it? He doesn't just invite Timothy to come. In fact, he says to Timothy, go get John Mark, wherever he is, and bring him with you, so that he might join you with me here. Paul desires for Mark to join him also because Mark is an integral part of the missionary and church planting effort, and that is who Paul needs in this hour of loneliness. Who Paul wants to see isn't just friends. Luke is there. Eubulus is there. Pudens is there. No, he doesn't want just friends. He wants people around him who have been involved in the ministry work he's been involved in. Why? Because he has a very close vision connection with them. They're close friends because they have worked together. Because they have a vision for expanding the message of Christ to the world. And so that's why he wants this young man to come. He's adding John Mark to the invitation because he wants to surround himself with a certain kind of people. Now, I debated with myself about whether or not Luke was part of that. I mean, we sort of automatically assume it, don't we, that Luke was a part of the inner circle of church planting. But it's very possible that he was not, and that's the reason why Luke is sort of treated like a second-class citizen in this picture. Because Paul is saying, yes, Luke is important, he wrote a gospel, he wrote a history, but he's not at the center of the church planting effort. John Mark and Timothy are. And those are the men that I want to have around me in the midst of that. Now, that was speculation, and you're welcome to disagree with me on that if you'd like. The next is Tychicus. You remember him? You remember Tychicus? Or Tychicus, I think is probably the better way to pronounce it. Tychicus was the messenger of Paul, the deliverer of the letter of Ephesians and Colossians and probably Philemon. You'll notice Paul says, I have sent him to Ephesus. Now, notice that. In the midst of his desire to be surrounded by men who have a mission, he purposely sends Tychicus to Ephesus. Now, why? Well, one reason could be to deliver this letter. That would be one reason, because we know that's what he does. But another reason could be that he wants Tychicus to go there to replace Timothy there for a brief time, to substitute, or better, to hold down the fort. Again, as I said about Brian, we're not substituting for each other. Tychicus is going to go there and do his work while Timothy goes and does something else, right? Okay, so Tychicus is simply, I think, sent by Paul to go to Ephesus and just hold down the fort until Timothy can get back. Tychicus is never spoken of in the New Testament as an integral member of this church planting effort. He's a messenger. He seems to be the guy that Paul can trust to take a piece of papyrus and deliver it somewhere. So, he's a good traveler. Carpus is mentioned only in passing. He's an unknown native of the city of Troas. No doubt this is a friend who had provided support and lodging in the city of Troas. You remember Troas was the port of travel into the Aegean that Paul had used on the just after the Macedonian call. During the second missionary journey, that at Troas, Paul had gone out and seen the man of Macedonia on the other side, come to us. And so they had taken off from Troas. Undoubtedly, this man Carpus had provided lodging. And Paul had felt comfortable enough with this man to leave his possessions there, a cloak, some parchments, and other kinds of things. So this Carpus was an important fellow, but he's probably not important in the sense of someone who's involved in the mission work per se. Next, Alexander the coppersmith, who we discover is a direct opposer of Paul. We'll come back to him in a minute. If you jump down to verse 20, you see Erastus. Erastus is mentioned as a helper to Paul. We learn in Romans 16 that he is possibly the city treasurer of the city of Rome, but he's now at Corinth. So he's not here. He's at Corinth. So again, another person who Paul may have trusted as a part of his inner circle, but he's away, sent ahead. You remember that he was sent ahead with Timothy as Paul left Ephesus for Jerusalem in Acts 19. And then finally, Trophimus, who is also a helper to Paul on his second journey, a native of Ephesus, who is now, Paul says, ill and has been left at Miletus to recover from his illness. So Paul mentions 10 different people, all in the various states of being away from him, with the exception of Luke, who is with him, and a few other names, which we'll see in a little bit, who are with him, but are not really part of this particular section. So Paul is saying, I think, through these 10 names, that these are people who are important to us, Timothy, important to us, in this work of advancing the cause of Christ. You and John Mark are to come to me, this is Paul speaking, you are to come to me because you are close to me. You have labored alongside of me, and you are some of my closest allies and friends in the world. I am convinced, and I'll debate you on this, But I'm convinced that Timothy was probably Paul's closest friend in the world. The closest person that Paul had in this world was Timothy. He doesn't speak of anybody else in the way that he does here. And you don't see anybody else's name listed alongside of his in his writings. Paul and Timothy send you this letter, for example. I'm convinced that Timothy was probably Paul's closest friend. So they labor together. So here's what Paul desires. He desires his friends, his closest friends in the world, to comfort him. And he still wants to be useful, even with the shadow of death hanging over him. Like I said, he thinks he has some time left, so he can still be useful. So his goal is to bring together two men who he considers to be important as the word goes forth from here. I want you, Timothy, to come to me, but I want you to bring John Mark too, because I think he's going to be important along the way as well. He invites these two men to join him for his own encouragement and strengthening, to provide continued training and mission support. Here's how Paul's going to get over his loneliness and despair. He's going to invite two men to come to see him in Rome, and he's going to spend some time with them continuing the training work that he's already started. That's how he's going to get over his loneliness. That's fascinating. But why does Paul feel this sense of loneliness in the first place? I mean, after all, he has sent these people out to various places, right? He has sent Christians, he has sent Titus. There are others that he has sent to other places along the way. What is it that exactly is it that has caused this feeling of loneliness? What has arisen that has driven this emotion out of the Apostle Paul? The primary reason is because Paul himself has experienced the effect of apostasy. Paul himself has experienced the effect of apostasy. And there are two men that Paul lists in this chapter who are central in that. Verse 10, for Demas, in love with this present world, that should really be translated in love with this present age, has deserted me and gone to Thessalonica. The word cosmos is not in that verse. I'm surprised that the ESV translators translate it with word. It should be age. In love with this present age. Now, who is this fellow? Demas is listed in both Colossians 4 and Philemon 24 as a fellow worker with Paul. He is someone who was involved in the work of Paul in his mission work. He is listed in these two letters, Colossians and Philemon, because apparently in his first imprisonment, because you remember Ephesians, Colossians, and Philemon were written during his first imprisonment, this man Demas was involved in his life in such a way that he was probably there in Rome with him, and had been involved in the various parts of the work of the missionary team at Paul's first arrest. Now, however, at Paul's second arrest, he has deserted Paul and has gone back to Thessalonica, suggesting he may be a native of Thessalonica. Now, the question that comes up then is Demas an apostate? Is he an apostate? Can we say that his desertion of Paul is an apostasy? Now, remember a minute ago I said that John Mark was not an apostate because he abandoned a work, right? He didn't abandon the faith, he abandoned a work. He demonstrated later through additional work that he was in fact still trusting in this Christ. He writes a gospel, he gets involved, Paul says he's still useful to me. Paul would never have said that about a man who's an apostate, right? Okay. So, John Mark left a work. But the way Paul writes it, he says, he has deserted me and gone to Thessalonica. So, is he an apostate? After all, if John Mark could not be considered an apostate because he abandoned a work, could Demas be considered not an apostate? I'm sorry, that was a double negative, but he may not be an apostate simply because he abandoned Paul in his imprisonment, right? But I think the answer is found in the way that he's described. Demas, comma, in love with this present age, comma, has deserted me. Paul gives a description of the man. He doesn't just say, Demas has gone back to Thessalonica. Demas has deserted me here and gone back to Thessalonica. No, he says, Demas, and here's the reason why, has deserted me. He is in love with this present age. Now, I want you to make sure you understand that in this present age, what that really means. It means the ideology of this world. The way the world thinks. Okay? It's a worldview issue. It's a worldview issue. The way the world thinks. A worldview centered around a worldly focus rather than a focus on Christ. Demas is not in love with Christ. He's in love with an ideology outside of Christ. Or we could say it this way. The love of the world's way of thinking overruled the love that Demas had for Christ. Paul describes Demas as having left because his love for the world overruled his love for Christ. It is the classic example of the weedy soil in the parable of the soils. Remember the parable of the soils, right? You got the four different kinds of soils that the seed lands on. And one of them we looked at a couple of weeks ago was the shallow soil, where it springs up quickly, but because it has no root, it dies off as soon as the heat comes out. But this is the other type. This is the weedy soil. This is the soil that's also infested with the seeds of weeds. And when the farmer throws his good seed in there, both kinds of plants grow up. And Jesus says, well, here's what it is. It's the Christian or the individual who professes a faith in Christ, but all the pressures of the world grow up with him, and as soon as they grow up, they choke him out. It's the ideology of the world that began to crush whatever faith, quote unquote, was found in the individual. Demas is an example of the second form of apostasy. Let me suggest to you that there are three forms of apostasy. The first form of apostasy is the overt type. An individual comes out and very publicly says, I don't want anything to do with this Jesus anymore. I'm leaving. I'm abandoning. I'm going off to the world. Okay? We've seen examples of that in the last few weeks. An individual who says, I'm denying the faith, publicly abandons the faith that he once held. Okay? But the second type, that's this one here, is the slow drift away from the faith. The slow drift. The individual who starts off looking as though they belong to the church and they stay for a while, but they slowly begin to drift away from a solid Orthodox faith. They begin to slide away slowly over time. Now, in many modern circles today, the term that's used for this is the term backsliding. You've heard this term? Okay, and in many Baptist churches, in synergist churches, the idea of backsliding is, well, because you can never really lose your salvation once you make some sort of profession of faith, you can never really lose it. You backslide. So you're still a Christian. You just have backslidden away from any evidence of it in your life. Well, there's no such thing. Backsliding is not a real thing. You are an apostate in that you have slid away slowly over time from the faith. Embracing forms of worldly ideology which seem, and only seem, but seem to coexist with genuine Christianity. See, I can be a part of the church and I can believe in this Jesus, but I can also believe this worldly ideology over here or this worldly ideology over here. See, I can believe that it's possible to be rich and to follow Jesus at the same time. See, I can pursue wealth as one of my primary goals, but I can also pursue Jesus at the same time. That's the idea. And what happens to such people is they begin to pursue Jesus less and less and pursue the worldly ideology more and more. That's the slow slide. We'll come to a third one in a minute. So Demas is, in fact, an apostate. He has fallen away. He has deserted Paul in the midst of his worst situation because he's more in love with the things of this world. He would rather believe things that the world believes rather than what Orthodox Christianity teaches. He's come to a crisis of faith, and he is found to be wanting. And so he is the classic apostate. The second is a man by the name of Alexander. Now, we don't know this for sure, but I'm going to go along with the assumption that this is possibly the excommunicated man of 1 Timothy 1:20. And I have a lot of reasons for saying that. Paul warns Timothy to beware of him, meaning that this Alexander is still around. And that's similar to the picture that is painted in 1 Timothy of this man who was excommunicated by Paul from the church because he had made shipwreck of his faith along with Hymenaeus, who was mentioned twice, you remember. Okay. So Paul warns this Timothy to beware of him, implying that Alexander is still around. Yes, he's been excommunicated, but he hasn't left. He's still bugging the church. And what Paul says is that this Alexander strongly opposed our message, implying that he opposed the Orthodox gospel message in the church, thus damaging it by his presence. Paul said, yes, I put him out of the church, but here's a man who didn't stay out. He came back. Maybe he faked his way back in by pretending that he had repented, that he was going to turn back to the real faith, and now he was somehow... Paul's warning Timothy, watch out for this guy. And again, I would ask this question, is he an apostate? And the answer is yes. The context of 1 Timothy suggests that Alexander was, in fact, a part of the church. Thus, he had some sense of the Christian faith, but he turned it into a rebellion. He had been a part of the church. He had to be excommunicated. So he had, at some point, made a profession of faith. Listen, in a first century context, you didn't go down to the local church and participate in worship there unless you had, in fact, made some sort of genuine confession of faith. It's not like our day where you can just pick a church and just walk in any old time. No. There was a church at Corinth. There was a church at Ephesus. And you went and you were involved in it. And you went because you were a believer. And by the way, you're dealing with persecution in these days of believers. And so to walk into that church, you're putting yourself at risk to do so. So he must have had some sense at the beginning of a connection. But he's abandoned it to become a rebel, which is the third form of apostasy. The first form is, I hate this Christianity, I'm done with it. The second form is that slow slide away from orthodoxy. But the third kind is the individual who abandons the faith but continues in the life of the church. Stays. Now, there's some overlap between two and three here, but it's an individual who may publicly renounce Christianity or he may slowly slide away, but guess where he stays? He stays in the church. He becomes an opposition within the church body to the true gospel. He stays in the church to remake it into his own image. His goal is to say, listen, I like this institution because it gives me an opportunity to find business contacts or it gives me a place to go where I can kind of pretend that I'm finding some sort of satisfaction or whatever. But I don't really like the gospel that's being preached there, so here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to stay in the church, and I'm going to try to mold it. I'm going to try to change the message. I'm going to try to divert the people. Paul has warned us about this for two straight letters, has he not? The entirety of 1 Timothy and 2 Timothy are related to this issue. Watch out for these kinds of people, Paul says. They're in the church. They're the third form of apostasy. So Alexander and Demas are put forward by Paul as two men who were significant to him. Demas was a co-laborer with him. Alexander was a member of the church at Ephesus where Paul had spent a good deal of time. There was a connection that Paul had with them. And guess what? Both of these men had abandoned the faith, one way or the other. Which means that even the Apostle Paul cannot avoid the reality of apostasy occurring amongst his own. Even the greatest church planter and scripture writer in the history of the world cannot avoid apostasy in his ranks. Should I put it this way? Just as Jesus had his Judas, Paul had his Demas. Just as Jesus had his Judas, Paul had his Demas. My brothers and sisters in Christ, listen to me. and listen carefully. The cultural opposition that is coming against the church will unleash a tsunami of apostasy in the days ahead, and this is normal after a period of cultural acceptance. Listen to me. Do not be naive, please. There will be many, even in a church such as this, who will abandon the faith in the next few years because the pressure of worldly ideology will capture them and pull them away from Christ. The last 200 years of comfort for the church here in America has created a wide swath of people who have embraced Christianity only because it's comfortable. Many will now leave when it isn't comfortable anymore. Make no mistake about it. And do not be surprised when you hear that so-and-so has left the church or so-and-so has abandoned the faith. That's normal. Even Paul experienced it. Probably the single greatest gospel teacher in the history of the world couldn't keep Demas and Alexander in the faith. But here's a bit of comfort behind all of this. When you read verses 9 to 22, and I realize I haven't read them, but you certainly can. If you notice how personally Paul takes this? Do you notice that? You see how personally he takes it? By the way, taking this personally is common. It is a common reaction to apostasy and abandonment. Notice that he says, Demas has deserted me. Alexander has opposed our message. No one stood by me in verse 16. See? Notice how personally Paul's taking it. Paul feels a very strong sense of personal abandonment at this time. This is what he's feeling. And he's writing this out. I want you to come, Timothy, because Demas, you remember him? Well, he abandoned me. He deserted me. That guy Alexander that we knew, watch out for him. He's a danger. And then all these other people are gone. I just feel this. He has experienced the direct result of apostasy. These 10 men are examples of both the positive and negative sense of this abandonment that Paul feels. Positive in the sense that he has sent some off. Negative in the sense that some have deserted him. But he's feeling this great sense of loneliness because he himself has been abandoned. And he feels that sense of abandonment. Listen, I can tell you from personal experience how personal it is when somebody abandons the church. People often think that pastors are robotic. We don't really feel anything. That, you know, people come, people go, whatever. Blessed be the name of the Lord, right? That's not true at all. We're human. And we take this stuff very personal. I mean, I spoke to a man not too long ago who told me, said, I'm leaving the church, but I don't want you to take it personally, Pastor. It's not about you. And I said to him at that point, I said, it is personal to me. Because you are not just abandoning me, you are abandoning everybody else in this church that you stood in the front of this church and took out that laminated sheet of paper and read that covenant in front of them and they read it with you and you abandoned us. Yes, I'm taking it personally. Not just because I'm your pastor or your preacher, but because I belong to the body that you're leaving. You've committed a sense of self-suicide and that you've decided to cut your own hand off. Paul feels this. But here's the good news. Verse 16, in my first events, no one came to stand by me, but all deserted me. May it not be charged against them. But the Lord stood by me and strengthened me so that through me the message might be fully proclaimed and all the Gentiles might hear it, so I was rescued from the lion's mouth. Notice what he says here. He says this. He says, listen. Before you get the impression that I'm living the rest of my days with this feeling of loneliness and abandonment, I want you to know that in the back of my mind and in my heart, I know that there is one who will never abandon me. There's that tension that exists within us. That tension. The tension of the grief and the despair of having been abandoned by others, that sense of loneliness, that sense of failure, that sense of whatever that you feel when somebody calls you and says, I'm leaving, I don't want to have anything to do with this anymore. And then that other sense of, wait a minute, there's one with a capital O who will never abandon us. Paul desires even to emulate this Jesus as the one who forgave his own executioners. He knows that while human beings may abandon him, the Lord will always stand beside him. He knows that he will be rescued by the Lord from every evil deed, like the abandonment that he's feeling. By the way, the evil deed he's talking about there is what Demas did to him, abandoned him. That's the evil deed. He is confident that the Lord will bring him safely into his heavenly kingdom. I will experience the presence of Christ. That's the opposite of abandonment, isn't it? The very presence of Christ himself, which is why I harp so much on the fact that our eternal reward is not a crown or a mansion or streets of gold. The eternal reward is Christ himself being in his presence. All of the other abandonments that we have experienced in our life will be erased by being with the one. Which leads him, of course, to his great doxology in verse 18. To him be glory forever and ever. All of this, even the suffering that he himself is experiencing, the loneliness, the depression, the abandonment, the desertion, all of these things are to the glory of this Christ. You see, as the paragraph itself unfolds, Paul moves from a sense of personal abandonment to a realization of the never-ending closeness of Christ, which is the very promise of Christ himself. I made mention a few weeks ago of the Great Commission, that we are to make disciples. The goal of the church is to make disciples. Yes, we're to call them to faith in Christ, but we're also to grow them in that faith, disciple them and grow them up. But how does the Great Commission end? With a promise. Lo, I will be with you even to the end of the age. Lo, I will be with you even to the end of the age. Do you think Jesus knew that we would feel abandoned and deserted by people who claim to be Christians? Do you think he knew that? Yeah, he did. He knew that. Thus, the invitation to Timothy, get this now, the invitation to Timothy and John Mark is a part of the promise of Christ. In Timothy and John Mark, Paul would experience the closeness of Christ. His friends and his co-laborers, Paul would know the presence of this Jesus. He would call for those he knew were committed to this Christ. He knew that they would never desert him. He knew that they would never abandon him in apostasy. And so he calls for them to come because he knows that through them, he's going to experience the closeness of this Christ. That promise is going to be literally fulfilled in these two men coming to see him. And that's what it means for you and I to gather together on a regular basis for worship and fellowship. It's because we gather together to remind ourselves that Christ is close. It's found in each of us together. At the end, then, Paul sends some greetings from some common friends, Prissa and Aquila, probably Priscilla and Aquila. You remember them, the long-term co-laborers with Paul, especially at Corinth, who are now at Ephesus. He sends greetings to the household of Onesiphorus, probably a prominent family of believers there at Ephesus. Onesiphorus probably being the male head over a family of people who were involved in the faith there. He's also mentioned, by the way, in 1 Timothy 1:16. And then four other people, Eubulus, Pudens, Linus, and Claudia, who were all friends in Rome that were common acquaintances to Timothy. Paul then signs the letter off with this. The Lord be with your spirit. And based on the context of everything that you've seen so far in this paragraph, this should be an easy thing to interpret. What does Paul mean by the Lord be with your spirit? Notice spirit in this case is in the lowercase, so it's not the spirit, but rather your spirit, your nature, your being as a person. And I think the answer of what that means is simple. May the Lord be close to you. May He give you refreshment and encouragement. May the Lord grant you grace in your days of darkness as He has in mine. Even if you're not able to make it here before I'm gone, the work that you are doing there in Ephesus, may the Lord be with you. May He be close to you. May He give you the kind of encouragement that I'm hoping you will come and give to me in Rome. What do we say about this letter? What do we say about the two letters we just read? Paul has been deeply concerned throughout this letter about the importance of a consistent and solid faith being, as he says in 2:2, entrusted to faithful men. A consistent and solid Orthodox Christianity that is being propagated in the church, entrusted to faithful men and passed on to another generation. Even in the face of those who would abandon it in apostasy or opposition, even as he himself has experienced it. The uppermost thought in the mind of the Apostle Paul is a warning. In some ways, this paragraph we just spent an hour on demonstrates this, doesn't it? I have experienced some of the deepest desertions and feelings of loneliness imaginable. But the primary mission of the church does not change. The apostates don't rule the roost. The apostates don't get to decide what the message is. The worldly ideology of those who have abandoned us to go after that do not get to rule what we are. These letters are a stark warning to all of us that we need to persevere in the faith once delivered to the saints. We need to persevere. We need to hold fast, endure to the end. And dare I say, what we should do is surround ourselves with those who want to see us grow in that faith. Paul wants to surround himself with men who he knew were committed to the gospel. That should be our desire. I want to surround myself with people who will help me to grow up in that faith. I'm not interested in surrounding myself with people who have only a slight understanding of these things or maybe have an apostate view of these things. That's not the goal. The mission of the church is for us to grow in the faith, to persevere in the faith. We surround ourselves with those who want to see us grow in that faith. We should shun those who would drag us away from trusting in Christ, the chief substitute. We should shun them. We should be, well, dare I say, happy. It's not a good word. I don't know what adjective to use. We should be happy that, in fact, at times there are those who abandon the church. Because if they're just going to be that third kind of apostate where they're going to stick around and be nothing more than opposers that want to drag us away from what we need to do, maybe it's better that we show them the door. That's okay. Or as one elder puts it, a blessed subtraction. The fact is that Paul is in these two letters more than anything else giving us a warning. Persevere in the faith. Endure to the end. Surround yourself with people who will help you grow in that faith. If you've got friends that all they want to do is convince you that worldly ideologies are the way you need to think, the best thing for you to do is to bid them farewell. And the same is true in the church. Persevere. Stay the course. Run the race. Keep the faith. Paul says, I've done it. I've experienced some of the worst forms of apostasy, loneliness, and depression. But you know what? It's okay. Because in the end, the one who will never abandon me is the one who I'm pursuing after. For me, these have been two interesting books, particularly relevant to our age. A day in which the church is being attacked, not from the outside, but from the inside. By men who would have us divide, not be unified. These are two letters that we should be keeping uppermost in our mind the very last things that Paul would write to a world saying, listen, if I have one thing to say to you, it's this. Stay the course. Persevere in the faith.